Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, March 22, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss the RJR Nabisco case and RICO's reach, argued yesterday in the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion on the call today are those of the expert. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome back our return guest, Richard A. Samp. He's Chief Counsel of the Washington Legal Foundation. He attended oral argument yesterday, and he's going to give us opening remarks of about 15 to 20 minutes, talk about the background of the case, and then bring us up to date as to what happened at oral argument. With that, Mr. Samp, the floor is yours.
Dean, thank you very much. The RJR Nabisco case is really a quite important tort reform case. The federal anti-racketeering law, RICO, includes a very powerful private right of action, and it has been broadly used in this country to essentially turn what are routine business disputes into claims that one's opponent is a racketeer. And of course, the reason that people who are plaintiffs enjoy bringing cases under RICO is that it has such powerful tools attached. In particular, it allows for treble damages, and it also allows for recovery of attorney's fees to prevailing plaintiffs. So the question in RJR Nabisco is, RICO already applies here in the United States. Can it be used to cover foreign disputes, so that if you are involved in a business dispute in Europe, can you sue your opponent in the United States under RICO and take advantage of the powerful tools that are part of RICO? Now, the issue of extraterritoriality of U.S. laws has been one that has been litigated heavily over the last 50 years or so. Most prominently, a decision by the court in 2010 by the name of Morrison versus National Australia Bank seemed to put some real brakes on the overseas application of U.S. laws. In particular, Morrison said, quote, when a statute gives no clear indication of an extraterritorial application, it has none. So in the Morrison case, the question was securities fraud. And in that particular case, the securities were exchanged in Australia. However, there was some U.S. Nexus of the lawsuit. In particular, the allegation was that the securities issuers in Australia had failed to provide information about fraud in connection with bank loans within the United States. And so the claim was that U.S. securities laws could apply because of that U.S. nexus. And so what the Supreme Court did in the Morrison case was to establish a focus test. It looked at what is the focus of the statute at issue, and what the court determined in Morrison was that the focus of Section 10B is the trading of securities, and that really the bank fraud in the United States was not the principal focus, and therefore, if you look at that focus, which was activity in Australia, the securities laws would not apply there unless there was something in the securities law that gave a very clear indication of extraterritorial application. And because there was no such clear application, the Supreme Court dismissed the claims. Another very important extraterritorial decision from the court came in 2013 in a case by the name of Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Petroleum. That case involved the Alien Tort Statute, which provides a right of action to aliens for torts in violation of the law of nations. And what typically has happened is that human rights groups have filed ATS suits against United States corporations based on their overseas activities. Typically, the claim is that the host foreign government has violated the human rights of some of its citizens, and that the U.S. corporation, by virtue of its support and tax revenues that it provides to the foreign government, has in some way aided and abetted these violations of human rights. And the Kiobel case pretty much shut the door to those kinds of lawsuits. The holding was that nothing in the ATS indicated that Congress had intended to have lawsuits under the ATS cover overseas activities, and therefore the presumption of Morrison applied. So that brings us to the RJR Nabisco case, which was argued yesterday. The basic factual allegations is that RJR, along with every other major tobacco company and every major liquor company, had been engaged in a money laundering scheme in Europe. And the basic argument was that drug dealers in South America had been selling drugs in Europe, and then they get euros, and then they sold those euros to money dealers in Europe so that they could get dollars in return, and then those dollars were provided to wholesalers for tobacco in Europe, and those wholesalers brought their dollars to RJR and others and said, we want to buy some cigarettes, and RJR sold them their product, which is, of course, what they normally do. So RJR is not alleged to have had any direct involvement with any drug dealers, but it's alleged to have apparently taken cash for the sale of its product, and that therefore they were complicit in money laundering. And it's important to note that this money laundering activity is not alleged to have taken place in the United States. It's alleged to have taken place either in South America or in Europe. So the question is, does RICO apply to these overseas activities? And so I think it's important to go through RICO very briefly. It's a complicated statute. There are three basic prohibited activities that are covered in 18 U.S.C. Section 1962. First of all, people are prohibited from investing the proceeds from any pattern of racketeering activities in an enterprise. And the essential genesis of the RICO statute was to go after organized crime in the United States, and it was and of course the organized crime would generate proceeds, and then they would invest in legitimate enterprises and take over those enterprises. So that's 1962A, which talks about investing the proceeds of racketeering activities. 1962B prohibits acquiring or maintaining control in an enterprise through a pattern of racketeering activity. And 1962C prohibits the conduct of that very same enterprise through a pattern of racketeering activity. Now, the pattern of racketeering activity is a defined term. Basically, it means that you have committed two or more criminal acts from a long list of federal and state laws that are included in RICO. And in this country, the most commonly used predicate acts are wire fraud and mail fraud, because obviously if you're accusing your opponent in a business transaction, business litigation, with fraud, there's going to be mail fraud or wire fraud. And so it makes it very easy to allege at least two acts of mail or wire fraud and to call your business dispute a racketeering activity and to sue under RICO. Now, in the the principal enforcer of RICO, of course, is the United States government. It has broad powers to go after organized crime and anybody else who has violated RICO, and to get an injunction against it, and to take the proceeds of any of these racketeering activities, and to give lengthy jail sentences to the racketeers. There is also, however, a private right of action that is created under RICO, and that is Section 1964C. That particular provision says that any person, quote, injured in his business or property by reason of a violation of Section 1962 has a private right of action. Now, nothing in RICO explicitly says one way or the other that that RICO itself applies extraterritorially. So I think there's a pretty strong argument that RICO does not apply extraterritorially, applying the presumption that was created in the Morrison case. However, it is true that if you go through the hundreds of predicate acts that are covered under RICO, some of them, such as money laundering, do explicitly apply extraterritorially. So the plaintiffs in this particular case are claiming that that RICO applies extraterritorially to the extent that any of the predicate acts that were committed apply extraterritorially. Interestingly, the plaintiff in this particular case is the European Union, and the original claim that they made was that by virtue of this racketeering activity, various European governments lost tax proceeds. This case was originally filed in the year 2000, but the court said, no, under the general revenue rules, you can't sue in the United States courts for the collection of revenues in this way. So the European Union then amended its complaint, and now their claim is a number of our member states are in the business of selling tobacco, and in some unspecified way, these state enterprises were damaged in their business model by the fact that RJR was able to sell the cigarettes in the manner that it did. Every other one of the plaintiffs, both in the liquor industry and in the tobacco industry, has settled the case, so it is only RJR that is still in court. RJR won its case in the district court on the grounds that there was no extraterritorial application of RICO. The Second Circuit reversed. It said that, yes, RICO does apply extraterritorially to the extent that its various enumerated crimes do apply apply extraterritorially, and for example, money laundering does apply extraterritorially. So the case was granted cert. It was granted cert before Justice Scalia's untimely death. So that's perhaps one less vote that RJR has for it. And the case was argued yesterday. And the principal argument, not surprisingly, of RJR is that the focus of RICO is on activities here in the United States. And the question really comes down to, is the focus of RICO the enterprise that is being corrupted by the racketeer, or is the focus the racketeering activity and the pattern of racketeering activity? If it is the former, and you have to focus on the enterprise itself, then pretty clearly RJR is going to win, because enterprise involved in this country, the enterprise involved in this case, the money laundering scheme, it took place entirely outside of the United States, and certainly there is nothing in RICO that would suggest that Congress intended this statute RICO to apply to overseas enterprises. On the other hand, if the focus is the pattern of racketeering activity, then given that some of that racketeering activity consists of predicate acts that are themselves applicable extraterritorially, then there is at least a plausible argument to be made for the EU in this case that they do have a plausible cause of action. The United States has intervened in the case by filing an amicus curiae brief, and the United States, interestingly, took a middle position in the case. What it said was, on the one hand, we think that the focus of Section 1962 that sets forth the prohibitions, that portion of the statute has two focuses. It focuses both on the enterprise and on the racketeering activity. And since racketeering activity, at least some of it, does apply extraterritorially, the United States government says that the prohibitions do apply to activities that occurred in Europe. And so that means, of course, the United States, if it so chose, would be permitted to bring criminal actions against companies that were engaged in activity in Europe that violated one of the predicate statutes. But on the other hand, what the United States says is that we agree with RJR that when you turn to the private right of action created by 1964C, the answer is different. That according to the United States, you must have an injury here in the United States in order to have a cause of action. 1964C creates a private right of action for somebody injured in his business or property, and nothing in Section 1964C gives any indication of extraterritorial application of that injury requirement, and therefore the United States says that in the absence of any real evidence that there was any injury to anybody here in the United States, that the decision of the Second Circuit can't stand. The United States was willing to say the case maybe should be remanded to the lower courts to give the EU an opportunity to establish some sort of injury within the United States, but I think it would be very difficult to show such an injury. So the bottom line really is that the United States is on RJR's side in this case. Now, in the argument yesterday, interestingly, there were only seven justices involved. Sandra Sotomayor apparently was involved in this case when it was in the Second Circuit, so she recused herself so that RJR will only need four out of the seven votes to win. And my very rough head count is the argument yesterday is that probably the four conservatives on the court are going to stick with the decisions that they issued in Morrison and Kiobel and will say no extraterritorial application. That's Roberts, Kennedy, Alito, and Thomas. My guess is that Justice Ginsburg is going to probably vote to affirm, and perhaps Justice Kagan as well. She seemed to think that that you really can't divvy up the statute and say, well, maybe the prohibitions of 1962 apply extraterritorially, but we're not going to apply the private right of action extraterritorially. She seemed to think it should be all one way or the other. So I suspect she may be a vote to affirm as well. Justice Breyer perhaps was the most interesting person at oral argument in that he was saying, you know, I want guidance from the State Department and I want guidance from the European community, and I'm just totally confused in this case because normally when we hear from the EU, it's in cases like Kiobel and in various antitrust cases when European states rant and rave about the United States injecting its law into activities taking place in Europe, and it should mind its own business. Yet in this case, we have the EU in Brussels, presumably speaking on behalf of all member states, saying we do want it to apply extraterritorially here. And he was saying basically the overseas application of U.S. antitrust laws has been a disaster over the years, and why do we want to extend it here to the area of RICO, which is likely to cause even more mischief. So he seemed genuinely undecided as to which way he was going to come out. I would say in general, one reaction I had was that the court was perhaps less focused on this case than it has been on some others. On yesterday morning, the 10 o'clock argument was a very hot bench. The court was arguing heatedly about redistricting standards and whether the Virginia congressional redistricting had been an illegal racial gerrymander or whether it was a mere partisan gerrymander, and the court was very actively engaged in that case, and I think that they were perhaps had used up a lot of their energy by 11 o'clock, and there was not a lot of interest in the case, and all of the attorneys were allowed to argue for extended periods of time without interruption, so that makes it a little bit more difficult to predict how the court is going to rule. But I don't think that merely because the court was perhaps somewhat less interested in the fine points of RICO, we shouldn't interpret from that that the case is not important. I think it is highly important. I think that if the Second Circuit is affirmed, you're going to see many more cases of this sort filed. And while RICO has always been a problem domestically, I think you'll find that that RICO will become even more of a problem in the future once people in Europe begin to catch on that they could bring their business disputes here to the United States and take advantage of the treble damages award. So with that, Dean, I will turn it back to you, and we can have further discussion on some of the fine points.
Terrific. Thank you so much. Let's open it up to questions now. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to indicate so. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see if someone rings in. Let me make a quick commercial announcement about our next Teleform conference call. It'll be tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Will be another Courthouse Steps edition of Teleform discussing the Zubik case, better known as the Little Sisters of the Poor case. That's being argued tomorrow, so our Teleform again is tomorrow at 3 p.m. Today we're talking to Richard Samp about the RGR Reynolds case and RICO. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open now. Let me ask you a question, if I could, while we wait to see if someone else rings in. Is there, and I agree that it seems odd that the EU is now sort of imploring the U.S. courts to apply a U.S. federal criminal statute extraterritorially. Was there an EU statute or any other sort of European law that EU itself could have brought suit against RJR Reynolds here?
Yes, they could. I mean, certainly the accusation is that RJR was in violation of money laundering statutes, and they could have filed suit in Europe against RJR. Apparently, RJR does not have any major subsidiaries in Europe. So David Frederick, the very able attorney arguing for the EU, tried to make the point that it might, given the limited number of assets that RJR has in Europe, might be difficult to actually collect on the judgment in Europe if they were to win one there. And so that's a reason to sue here. That really doesn't explain the fact that the EU from the very beginning sued everybody here in the United States. But David Frederick was really quite apologetic about this in the treble damages provision at several points. So that at one point I thought it was rather odd. He said, I'm authorized by my client to say that if we win this case, we will not seek treble damages. And I'm not quite sure why they did that other than to sound more reasonable. But of course, if the court rules in favor of the EU and reinstates this lawsuit, while the EU might be bound by that concession, that certainly would not bind future plaintiffs. So you can expect that that they would be seeking treble damages here in the future. But in answer to your initial question, there's no question that RJR could have been sued in Europe. And I think that was one of the points that Justice Alito made repeatedly, was that there would be no problem at all getting personal jurisdiction over RJR in Europe.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. Let me ask you another question about the RICO statute while we wait. I take it there is no distinction at all when it comes to a private right of action between a private individual or a private party or a company and a foreign government.
That's correct. The one limiting feature of the RICO statute is that it only applies, the private right of action only applies to injury to one's business or property. So it doesn't apply to personal injury actions. But so long as a foreign government has a business or property interest, it's entitled to sue. Interestingly, one of the points that was harped on by Justice Kagan was the fact that following September 11th, 2001, RICO was amended in order to include more terrorism-related predicate acts under RICO, and she seemed to think that that indicated that Congress really wanted this to apply overseas. And I think the appropriate response to that from RJR was that, well, most of the September 11th events took place here, and also to the extent that you're talking about personal injury claims, RICO really doesn't provide anything for that whatsoever. Probably the strongest argument that the other side has is that there are among the hundreds of predicate acts included under RICO, there are perhaps two or three at most statutes that only have extraterritorial application. And so one of the questions from Justice Breyer to RJR is, what possible reason would Congress have had to include those statutes here if it did not intend that RICO could ever have extraterritorial application? And RJR is really their only response was, well, there are hundreds of statutes, and there really wasn't a whole lot of thought as to which specific ones were included here. So the fact that, for example, one of the covered statutes is injury to an American citizen at a foreign airport, well, obviously that only applies extraterritorially, but RJR makes the point that there really was just simply a wholesale inclusion of huge numbers of predicate acts like that without a whole lot of thought as to what would be the application. But it is the inclusion of those couple of predicate acts that leads me to believe that the court may well end up adopting the United States' middle position, which is that even though the United States can use RICO for extraterritorial criminal prosecutions, that the private right of action only should apply in the United States.
Right. And I'm curious, in a lot of the ATS, the Alien Tort Statute actions, there's sometimes a view of the State Department represented. Was there any such indication here about a State Department interest in this case?
Yes, and in fact, when the Solicitor General got up and argued for their position, they said, we make it very clear that we do represent the views of the State Department, among others, that we see a serious problem of a lack of comity if United States courts start asserting jurisdiction over what are essentially foreign disputes.
Okay, and again, if you're in the audience, we don't have any questions yet. You could ask the first question by pushing star and then pound on your telephone. I'm going to ask a question about the predicate acts. You've mentioned that hundreds of them are included or incorporated sort of by reference into the RICO statute. Is there, and you've mentioned the Morrison case as, I guess, the key precedent, is there any hint at all in the precedent about whether or not those predicate acts would be the driving language in terms of statutory interpretation in determining extraterritoriality? The second question there is, in its pleadings, did the EU, the European Community, allege particular predicate acts? And do those have the language about the extraterritorial application?
The answer to your second question is yes, they do cite very particular predicate acts. In particular, they rely on the money laundering statute. And as I mentioned, the money laundering statute quite clearly does apply overseas. And so that, for example, there is nothing to stop the EU from filing a money laundering lawsuit against RJR. They wouldn't, of course, then be able to get treble damages. But also RJR says, quite candidly, we have no problem with the EU filing suit here in the United States against us if it wants. But in general, the common law rule has always been that if a country like the United States entertains a cause of action against a United States defendant in U.S. courts, that the law to be applied is the law of the place where the actions occurred, so that the parties all seem to agree, there are plenty of European or South American statutes that could be applied in this particular case. If the EU really wants to sue in the United States, they could. It's just that they would have to sue under European law, not under RICO. And of course, advantage of suing in the United States is lost if you can't sue under RICO, because it's the hugely powerful tools provided by RICO that drove this suit in the first place.
Right. Once again, let me make another call for questions. Push the star button, then the pound button. Our lines are open. This is a pretty intricate case. I wonder, you spoke a little bit about the effects, the likely effects of this case sort of in broader terms. If the Second Circuit is affirmed, that is, if RICO applies outside the United States, I want to maybe you can spend a couple more minutes going over that in a little more detail.
Well, I think everybody here in the United States recognizes how easy it is to turn any sort of business dispute into a RICO dispute. Now, the easiest tools to be used are the predicate acts of wire fraud and mail fraud, and those generally aren't deemed to apply overseas. So there might be some limitations on the ability of people to turn foreign business disputes into RICO disputes. But money laundering is such a very broad concept that I really don't think it would be all that difficult for most imaginative lawyers to argue that somebody who you're having a business dispute with was engaged in money laundering. I mean, all you need to do really is to allege that you have been defrauded by your person who you're engaged in a business transaction, and then you would simply need to argue that that the proceeds of that fraud were laundered in some way, meaning you transferred the money in some way. Given how easy it is to bring claims of that sort, I think you would find that people would regularly bring that. And then, of course, I mentioned earlier the Alien Tort Statute. And in that particular instance, the typical claim is that U.S. corporations operating overseas are aiding and abetting human rights violations by the host government. Well, it would seem to me that it would be quite easy to allege that that same aiding and abetting activity also perhaps would involve money laundering. And so that if I were a human rights plaintiff who was interested in calling American corporations into account here in U.S. courts for their overseas activities, and realizing, as I think most of them do now, that there really isn't a great future in bringing ATS cases. And we're seeing, I think, a decrease in the number of new cases following the Kiobel decision, that it would be a fairly easy activity, a fairly easy process to for human rights activists to now pivot and start calling all of their cases RICO cases. The one limitation on that is, of course, they would not be able to sue for personal injuries. RICO is limited to injury in one's business or property, but I suspect it would not be that difficult to find local residents who don't like their local government to claim that their business and property was injured. Perhaps their house was taken from them, perhaps their business was disrupted, and if the American corporation was aiding and abetting that kind of activity, it would be very easy to say that under RICO, the American corporation was complicit in the human rights activity violations.
Very interesting. It looks like we're not going to get a question from the audience here, so let me give you a chance to express a final thought or wrap up if you'd like.
Well, I do think that having come away from the oral argument yesterday, and I'm obviously a partisan on the side of RJR, the Washington Legal Foundation filed a front of the court brief in the case. We are generally supportive of what I would call tort reform activities. And I do think it is likely that the court is going to rule in favor of RJR. The one possible wrinkle is that the court will agree with the United States that that the RICO prohibited activities do apply extraterritorially, but I suspect at the end of the day the court at a minimum is going to say that in the absence of evidence that somebody was injured here in the United States, they cannot sue in the United States courts, and the EU really cannot, as far as I can tell, plausibly argue any injury here in the United States to their European tobacco operations. So I am hopeful that the case is going to turn out the right way, and I think that going forward, however, I think it becomes all that much more critical that new members named to the Supreme Court are cognizant of the need to cut back on adventurous tort lawsuits of this kind.
Very good. Well, my thanks to you, Richard Samp, of the Washington Legal Foundation. Certainly appreciate you being here today and having attended oral argument. To the audience, thank you as well for dialing in. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleform conference call is tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern time, when we'll be talking about the Little Sisters of the Poor case being argued tomorrow. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.